This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, January the 26th, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, in Egypt, anti-government protests continue as crowds defy a ban on demonstrations. Anti-war activists in Chicago refuse to testify before a grand jury. And we'll look at the economic recovery following President Obama's State of the Union address. Those stories and more, but first, these news briefs.
I'm Leanne Caldwell with these news briefs. An international arrest warrant has been issued for Tunisia's former authoritarian leader, Ben Ali, and some of his family. The interim Tunisian government asked the international law enforcement body, Interpol, to issue the warrant, which is for, quote, theft and currency offenses. Meanwhile, protests and skirmishes with police continue in the capital city, Tunis, as demonstrators want the interim government to be free from politicians connected to Ben Ali. Ben Ali was ousted by popular uprising after 23 years of dictatorial rule. At least five miners have been killed in an explosion at a mine in the northeastern part of Colombia. At least a dozen more are missing. Gas buildup is likely to have caused the blast. This is not the first time the mine has seen devastation. 30 miners died in an explosion in 2007. The Republican majority in the House of Representatives voted to end public financing of presidential elections. It's part of their efforts to reduce federal spending, and this measure would save more than $600 million in the next decade. Freshman Republican Rob Woodall of Georgia.
This proposal today is one small step towards attacking that operating deficit.
Opponents say ridding elections of public financing will lead to more corporate influence in campaigns. New York Democrat Louise Slaughter.
The Presidential Election Campaign Fund is the one place in the electoral system that we take some of the pressure off of candidates who otherwise have to raise bushels of private money.
Taxpayers choose on their tax forms if they want to contribute $1 or $3 to this fund. During the 2008 presidential elections, President Obama was the first major candidate to opt out of public financing. Turkey released a report on the May 2010 attack on an aid flotilla. The report says the attack by Israel was, quote, premeditated, and that Israeli soldiers used an excessive amount of force. Israel released its own report earlier this week and called the attack justified. The aid flotilla was headed to Gaza from Turkey when Israeli soldiers seized the boat and killed nine. And that's some of the news of the day. For FSRN, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. Anti-government demonstrations continued for a second day in Egypt as crowds defied a ban on protests and defended themselves from tear gas and rubber bullets. Video posted by Russia Today shows tensions continued throughout the night as throngs of riot police shot guns into the air and sprayed crowds with a water cannon. Police have detained more than 800 people, according to The Guardian, some of them violently. The media outlet's own Cairo correspondent, Jack Schenker, was beaten and thrown into a dark, crowded security bus with dozens of others. He used a recording device to document what was happening.
So we're in the back of a central security truck after being severely beaten and herded into a sort of holding pen in downtown Cairo. They then transferred us onto the truck and a few more beatings, and we're now being driven out to the desert. And the police have been incredibly violent with all of us in the truck, and we're herded in here. There must be between 30 and 40 people in a very confined space.
More than 40, you think?
No, yeah.
This car, maybe 60 people or something, and then another cars will get more.
So in this truck, we're now thinking somewhere around 50, maybe even 60 people. More than I thought.
One of the Egyptians rounded up with Schenker expressed concern about where they might be taken.
What do you think will happen to us?
I have no idea. At the beginning, I was hoping that they were going to try
drop us off in the middle of the desert, because that's what they sometimes do. They arrest people and then they drop them off in the middle of the desert. But now that apparently we are parked in front of the state security forces center in the middle of the desert, which is even more concerning, because not only is it state security forces headquarters, but it's in the middle of the desert. And it's behind, you know, the big wall and closed doors and everything.
Shenker said they eventually released all but one detainee, the son of a well-known dissident, Ayman Noor. Thousands have been protesting in Cairo and other cities since yesterday, in a movement inspired by Tunisia's popular uprising that forced President Ben Ali from power. Some Egyptians are hoping for the same result with their president, Hosni Mubarak, who's ruled the country for 30 years. For more on why these protests were organised, the Real News Network spoke to Miret El Nagar, special correspondent for McClatchy newspapers in Cairo.
These were the biggest demos Egypt has witnessed in decades. They were orchestrated by informal youth movements, as one called the 6th of April movement, which urged Egyptians to join what they called a day of revolt. And they called on them on the social networking site Facebook to join this protest today. At first, it started as a trickle, but then it really galvanized into thousands of people who marched down Cairo's downtown streets and in at least five other cities across Egypt, from the northern port city Alexandria on the Mediterranean to the southern tip in Aswan. It's hard to give a clear estimate of how many people attended. It was in the thousands, basically. Today's revolt marked the police day, which is a national holiday. However, it was to remind the police that they should be protectors rather than harassers, as they have been, as the Egyptian public criticizes them of being for the past few years. Egyptians on the street today were demanding better wages, a dignified way of earning their bread and butter, and less torture by police. So the grievances are very similar to those shared by the Tunisian people and, in effect, by people across the Arab world. Egyptians have been making these demands for some while. They seemed the protests had lost a little steam in the past few years, but this Tunisian uprising, I think, gave them momentum again and reminded them of their grievances and made them actively ask for them again. The police tolerated the demos for a while, but then towards the afternoon, they dispersed the protesters with tear gas, rubber bullets, water hoses. However, the protesters managed to regroup again in side streets. Later in the day, the government interrupted access to online news sites and Twitter and jammed the cell phone signals in downtown Cairo, which are all measures that show the Egyptian government is perhaps more alarmed than it is admitting, since President Hosni Mubarak's regime generally allows such outbursts and venting rather than giving real political concessions. Will take much, much more effort and many more protests to even shake the Egyptian regime, because the police and military are much more unified and supportive of Mubarak's regime, and they widely benefit from it as well.
That was Miret El Nagar, special correspondent for McClatchy newspapers, speaking to the Real News Network from Cairo. The US government, which provides Egypt with more than $1 billion in military aid each year, urged Egyptian authorities to allow people to peacefully protest, but called on all parties to exercise restraint. You're listening to FSRN. Today, FSRN continues our coverage of the Palestine Papers, more than 1,600 confidential files related to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and leaked to Al Jazeera. The Qatari-based news outlet shared the files with The Guardian, and both have been publishing investigations this week. The files include emails, maps, memos, minutes from private meetings and PowerPoint presentations dating from 1999 to 2010. So far, the documents have shown the extent of the Palestinian Authority's willingness to make concessions to Israel and their deep disappointment with the Obama administration's efforts in the peace process. For a Palestinian reaction to these leaks, we go to Nadia Hijab, co-director of Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Yes, thanks for having me.
In a YouTube video posted by the Institute for Middle East Understanding, you say this release of documents has really shaken things up. Why?
Well, for 19 years, you've had a so-called peace process that has involved a very small, select number of people meeting in rooms, generally behind closed doors, and nothing happening for 19 years. And even though The U.S. effort to resume direct negotiations or even indirect negotiations between Palestinians and Israelis has collapsed in the last couple of months. We still haven't seen anything to change the approach to the peace process. It's true that the Palestinian Authority is trying to approach other countries to get recognition of Palestine, but that's and to take the case to the United Nations and also to ask the United Nations for a settlement freeze, but that's still moving within parameters of something that's been defunct for a long time. If you judge a process by results, there just hasn't been any movement. And now come these revelations that show just how meaningless this has been, that Palestinians have been negotiating basically without any response from the Israelis, especially in the last 2 or 3 years, and with little or no support from the Americans, neither this administration nor the previous one.
The extent of the lack of confidence of Palestinians in the peace process and the Obama administration's handling of that has been surprising to some. And in the documents, Palestinian officials are quoted as saying, in the context of the Annapolis negotiations, confidence on the Palestinian street with respect to its leadership towards Israel and the international community as a whole is at an all-time low. Do you share that lack of confidence?
Yes, I mean, I think I do. As I said, there hasn't been any engagement of anyone other than a small, select group of actors. The only times they change, really, is when someone dies. And the approach followed has been the same and has brought absolutely no results. I mean, how much longer do you have to wait than 19 years? Now, in a sense, myself personally, and I think other Palestinians as well, would prefer to have no results than the extremely bad results that would have happened if Israel had signed on the concessions that the Palestinians were making. I think it would be really disastrous for Palestinian human rights, which are recognized under international law, to have accepted the kind of concessions that Palestinian negotiators were apparently willing to make without any mandate, really, from the Palestinian people.
Some of those concessions that are revealed in the papers, 2009 negotiations involving the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, and he offered to allow the return to Israel of only 1,000 Palestinian refugees per year when there are nearly 5 million in Palestinian, Lebanon, Jordan, around the world, and that Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat actually agreed to that. What did you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think the Palestinian negotiators were trying to hold out for something like 10,000 a year for 10 years, so 100,000 in all. And that's not new to this group of negotiators. I mean, it dates back to the late Yasser Arafat's time from the year 2000, when it was rumored that at Camp David, the figure of 100,000 refugees going home was needed by the Palestinian negotiators to save face or to show that they had done, you know, their utmost to bring refugees back. And I think the really the sort of the killer for Palestinian refugees would be Saeb Erekat not only saying that a limited number would go back, but also saying that the number that could come back to the Palestinian state every year would have to depend on the Palestinian state's absorptive capacity. I mean, of course, there's a logic to that, but at the same time, it's a big blow to people who have not been engaged in the process and have not been told anything of what's been going on.
What impact do you think the release of these papers will have on transparency and accountability in future peace negotiations?
I think it would be very hard for the Palestinian Authority to return to negotiations. So unless they're able to quickly nurture and regenerate sources of power, like reunifying the Palestinian body politic, looking into serious engagement with the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, you know, really ramping up effective diplomatic representation, effective outreach to the media, then I don't see what options they have for staying in power in future.
Nadia Hijab, co-director of Al Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks very much for inviting me on.
FSRN has experienced some trying times recently. Funding shortfalls nearly took us off the air. But because of you, our listeners, FSRN has survived. Your generous donations have saved this newscast from the brink. Thanks. But the fight is not over. FSRN staff will continue to offer scaled-back programming through January while we develop our long-term sustainable strategy. That's where you come in. Please help our sustainability fund by visiting fsrn.org. The non-partisan Congressional Budget Office released a bleak assessment of the nation's economy. CBO Director Doug Elmendorg says the economic recovery is lethargic and is seeing the slowest recovery since the Great Depression. He projects that 2.5 million jobs will be created each year, but that unemployment won't drop below 9% until next year. He says the sluggish economy has had a drain on the national deficit.
There are several factors that have meant that the budget deficit has not started to improve in the way that the economic news might suggest. I think the most important one is simply that the economy is recovering slowly. That although output has been growing, it has not been growing at the rate that one might have expected based on past experience in our country with deep recessions. In fact, the slow recovery is consistent with international experience following recessions caused by financial crises.
The annual report is done to assess government policies for the immediate year, as well as the long-term impact for the next 10 years. Elmendorf says that if current policies stay the same, the deficit will reach $1.5 trillion this year. That makes the deficit the highest percentage of GDP for three consecutive years since 1945. The CBO's figures have been readjusted since their August report. They now project the deficit to be $400 billion worse for the next 3 years because of an extension of the Bush tax cuts, the estate tax, and other tax extensions. Kent Conrad, top Democrat on the Senate Budget Committee, says the CBO analysis is another wake-up call.
We are borrowing 40 cents of every dollar that we spend. You cannot continue that much longer. On top of that, if you look at the revenue and the expenditures, in 2009, the revenue was the lowest it has been in 60 years as a share of the economy. Spending in that same year was the highest it has been in 60 years as a share of the economy. That tells me that you've got to work both sides of the equation.
The CBO also said that entitlement programs, namely Medicaid, Medicare, and the Children's Health Insurance Program, could increase from 10% of the GDP to 16% by the year 2035 if changes are not made. Stimulating the flagging US economy, detailed in that CBO assessment, was a focus of President Obama's State of the Union address. Obama emphasized the importance of education and the need to invest in renewable energies, but also said painful cuts will be necessary.
I am proposing that starting this year, we freeze annual domestic spending for the next 5 years. Now, this would reduce the deficit by more than $400 billion over the next decade and will bring discretionary spending to the lowest share of our economy since Dwight Eisenhower was president.
For reaction to the president's speech and how it dealt with key issues, including the economy, Letters and Politics host Mitch Jesrich spoke with George Lakoff, Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics from the University of California.
Professor Lakoff, it's good to have you here.
What a pleasure to be here.
What was President Obama's mission tonight with his statement, and do you think he achieved it?
His mission, he had a couple of missions. One, to show he was in charge, and I think he achieved that. Second, the mission was to split off the business community from the hard right wing. And we'll see if he achieved it.
How did he try to do that?
By talking about investment, by using the language of competitiveness. Basically, he was using the framing of business to talk about America as a corporation. And when you do that, and saying we all have to do this together, because in a corporation, everybody has to work together because they're competing against other corporations. Now, America is not a corporation. It doesn't work like a corporation at all. But still, he said, nothing will happen if we don't work together. And I think he knows perfectly well that the hard right is not going to work with him. They're going to do everything they can to defeat him. And so he tried a Clinton technique, which was to speak the language of the hard right, to say, okay, government needs reorganization and reform. I'm going to do it.
Some have said that this State of the Union address will be President Obama's first speech towards his reelection campaign.
No question. It certainly is. And it gives the old theme of, you know, no red states or blue states, only red, white, and blue states. We all have to hang together. This is unity, et cetera. And Americans like to hear that for good reason. That is the major theme that's behind this. And I think he understands full well that the hard right is never going to give in to that, that there really is a divide between a strict father kind of republicanism one that cares about people. And what he's trying to do is get the people who care to, be on his side, but also realize that, the business of America is business, that Democrats and Republicans are both involved in business, and people in business do care about the reality of economics. They don't want just to have an ideological economics. They want one that actually works and works for the country and serves their communities and so on. I think he correctly wants to get people in business who are solid citizens, who care about the long-term economy and their communities behind them. And this is his first attempt to do that in a very real way. It may have been successful, and it may continue to be successful.
Does President Obama's, which seems like to be an embrace of the center, help him electorally with the mainstream, with the majority of people who go to vote?
Well, there is no one center. There are a lot of people who are progressive in some ways and conservative in others. And so the question is he going to get those folks? Is he going to split off those Republicans who, voted with the Tea Partiers from the Tea Party? And that's what he, I think, tried to do tonight. That's what he'll continue to try to do. And the response from the hard right was clear. This isn't investment, it's spending. When I hear the Democrat talk about investment, I hear spending, where, we're in debt, et cetera. Well, he said, okay, we're going to freeze that kind of spending. Of course, it's only 12% of the budget. The rest is largely military and other kinds of things that the Republicans don't want cut. But there's a real rhetorical question here that's important. When you start using conservative talk and conservative framing, you wind up helping conservative ideas. What you're doing is saying the conservatives are basically right. The government does need to be reformed.
Did he do that?
Yes, he did. He starts saying America as a family, and then he goes to America as a corporation. And then the question is, he's trying to use both. He's trying to use two metaphors that don't fit together. There are a lot of people in the country who have both of those views. They're biconceptual. They think both in both those ways.
That was Letters on Politics host Mitch Jezrich, who was speaking with George Lakoff, Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics from the University of California. 9 Chicago political activists were ordered to appear in front of a federal grand jury Tuesday to answer questions relating to a widening federal probe into allegations of material aid to terrorism. All 9 refused to honor those subpoenas. FSRN's Chris Giovannis reports from Chicago.
On September 24th, more than 70 federal agents raided the homes and offices of anti-war, labor, and solidarity activists in Minneapolis and Chicago, carting away computers, cell phones, and personal belongings. The FBI also ordered 14 people to appear before a federal grand jury, including 10 trade unionists and 2 teachers. In December, officials subpoenaed another 9 activists in Chicago, 6 of them Palestinian Americans. On Tuesday, those activists joined the first 14 in refusing to appear. Jim Fennerty is one of the attorneys representing the targeted activists.
Most of their focus is on their support, the people here's support for Palestine, for the Palestinian people, and particularly a women's group in the West Bank that these people have supported and worked with. These people aren't terrorists. They're not in terrorist organizations. They're not involved in any destruction of property or injuring people.
The consequences of refusing to appear before a federal grand jury can be severe. One Palestinian activist, Dr. Abdel Halim Ashkar, was acquitted in 2008 in Chicago of federal terrorism-related charges, but then imprisoned for an unprecedented 135 months for refusing to cooperate with the grand jury. Maureen Murphy works for the online journal Electronic Intifada and is one of the 9 subpoenaed activists who refused to testify in front of the grand jury on Tuesday.
My understanding is that if we refuse to testify again and we try to invoke our Fifth Amendment rights again, then we will face the reality of being put in jail for civil contempt of court, potentially for the life of the grand jury.
The U.S. definition of who or what constitutes a terrorist group is itself not clearly defined. At times, the U.S. has called groups like the PLO and the African National Congress, the leading political project in the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, terrorist groups.
You know, those are unilateral designations by the State Department.
Hatem Abudaya is one of the activists who was subpoenaed in September and who refused to appear before the grand jury.
Just about every political party, every resistance organization in Palestine is on that list. We also know that there are not that many independents, so to speak, in Palestine. 90% of the Palestinian people support one of those resistance movements or political parties.
Last June, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a ruling upholding a law that makes it illegal to provide material support or resources to designated terrorist organizations. Attorneys for the activists suspect that the high court's ruling served as part of the impetus behind the case against the Solidarity activists. Dozens of civic groups, anti-war projects, and labor organizations have passed resolutions supporting the activists, including SEIU Local 73, one of the largest unions in the Midwest. Their president, Christine Boardman, spoke at a Tuesday rally to support the activists, one of whom is a member of her local.
What we have seen in every single major social movement where people fought for peace and justice, what happened? You end up having different right-wing elements try to repress them, try to hold down a movement.
Testimony in front of the grand jury may ultimately prove to be a moot point, at least in terms of giving the government a chance to amass more information to craft indictments. Earlier this month, the activists identified a law enforcement agent known as Karen Sullivan, who, beginning in April of 2008, infiltrated a group organizing protests against the 2008 Republican National Convention in Minneapolis. Attorneys for the activists believe that Sullivan could play a key role in any effort to prosecute them in open court. Federal officials, who declined to comment for this story, have privately told activists' attorneys that they're prepared to move forward with formal indictments now. Chris Giovannis, Free Speech Radio News, Chicago.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp and Leanne Caldwell. Our technical producer at KPFA in Berkeley is Scott Pham. Thanks to KPFA, Mitch Jesrich, Nathan Moore, Julie Alexander, the FSRN Board and Steering Committee, and many others for relentless work to make sure FSRN stays on the air. For more information on how you can support FSRN, go to our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.